You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Janis Chalovich, combating pancreatic cancer among Ashkenazic Jews through the Purple Pansies nonprofit. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We are now about 2 weeks from Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year of 5782, which means it's a period of intense preparation for rabbis, cantors, and congregations. But this year has been a curiously confusing time for many synagogues as the Delta variant of the COVID-19 pandemic circulates through society. While this may not be the most urgent question for most Jews, for those of us in the shul business, the return of coronavirus infections and hospitalizations raises a major issue. Just how open are we going to be this year for services? In other words, are people going to be able to attend shul to hear the shofar in person, to listen to Kol Nidre, offer prayers during Yisker, and see and greet all the members of their congregations on the Jewish days of awe when attendance is always at its highest, or not? Last High Holy Days and those pre-vaccine days of fear and confusion back in 2020, we were all pretty limited in how we conducted our services. Even my own congregation, Beit Simcha, which has had online options since March of 2020, but has continued to hold live services in our sanctuary throughout the pandemic, albeit with severely limited attendance, masks, and social distancing. Even we had limits on in-person attendance last Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. No more than 25 people at one time, well spread out, wearing masks. We had many people attend on Facebook, and they could, I guess, comment, but it wasn't as though you could hear a full congregation singing L'Shana Tova or Zachrinu L'Chaim or Barosh Hashanah in front of you or around you during services. And for those people attending at home, using the online Machzor, the High Holy Day prayer book, it must have been a pretty different experience as well. Not exactly alienating, but surely not the same as feeling fully part of a congregation and community. The way you feel when you are there in person, celebrating or atoning or sharing a pre- or post-service conversation with friends and relatives, or making a snide comment about the sermon to the person next to you. Well, we've all been excited since the vaccinations got going back in February and through the spring and summer, building anticipation, ready to embrace being fully open for the High Holy Days this time around. We really can't wait to return. It's a kind of tshuva, right? To feeling normal, being fully present in every sense for these most important religious days of the Jewish year. Our expectation was that this year, 5782, would be a year of healing and hope, of unity, recovery, and great growth. And then we have all had to pause and consider the possibility that the Delta variant and breakthrough infections may not make it quite as safe to be open as we hoped. Oy. And those who were already super worried decided to just have Zoom services or Facebook Live services or whatever platform they choose to use. And those who were deeply concerned and now requiring vaccination cards be uploaded before attending, restricting in-person attendance to some small numbers spread around the outskirts of the building or something like that. And masks are coming back, and so is social distancing. And of course, everybody wants you to wash your hands about as often as Lady Macbeth did, even if this actually has nothing to do with preventing COVID-19. I mean, it's a good idea, but still. Look, I cannot judge how others are choosing to restrict attendance on the High Holy Days this year. It is a difficult question. It involves responsibility in a variety of areas. But I can say that when you only can attend virtually, something critically important about community prayer, repentance, and sanctity is lost. There are always trade-offs in this world, right? My own congregation, Beit Simcha, here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, as fully informed as everybody else, we are all amateur virologists nowadays, aren't we? Well, we've decided that we will be open to our capacity this year for the High Holy Days. We are asking family and friend groups to stay together for seating, pushing rows 6 feet apart, recommending masks for the unvaccinated and everyone when they are not at their seats, serving any food carefully so that congregating, at least for food and kiddush, is limited. Of course, all of our services will be broadcast on our Facebook channel. But at Beit Simcha, at my synagogue, in our sanctuary, carefully and we pray safely, we will be together. And for that, I'm profoundly grateful. Because the truth is that communal prayer lies at the heart of Jewish experience. Online isn't really in person. To play us in this morning for the coming High Holy Days, here's the prayer sung during the shofar service on Rosh Hashanah, Areshet Tzfatenu. Open our lips before you, so our prayers together will be accepted.
Mevino mabit mazin makshiv lekol tekioseinu.
Mevino mabit mazin makshiv lekol tekioseinu.
Uskapel berachamim berachmim uverotzon seider malchu yoseinu.
Uskapel berachamim berachmim.
That was Areshet Tzfatenu, as sung by cantor Alberto Mizrahi, for the coming High Holy Days, beginning Monday night, September 6th. Make your arrangements now. Welcome to come to us at Congregation Beit Simcha. When we return on to Jewish in a Moment, our guest, Janice Chalovich, will discuss combating pancreatic cancer among Ashkenazi Jews through the Purple Pansies nonprofit. Find out how dangerous it can be, how to get diagnosed, how they help, all when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the northwest of Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses. We have a great array of new classes this fall, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Please join us for our in-person High Holy Day services or on our Facebook Live by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, to register, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome both members and guests in our sanctuary safely and in person, but also online. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Sign up for both Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Slichot coming up the end of August. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or email me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. We will continue to hold our services with full music in person as well as by virtual experience on our Facebook Live page, on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are both live and on Zoom. You can access those at BeitSimchaTucson.org, and our wonderful religious school is available in blended format, some students live, most now, and some on Zoom. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, the High Holy Days, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course, all of our services in person and on Facebook. Go to BeitSimcha, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Janice Chalovich, and a descendant of Ashkenazic Jews, is here to talk about a very serious subject, pancreatic cancer and its prevalence among certain ethnic groups, in particular Ashkenazic Jews. And I'll let her tell you her own personal story about that. Her nonprofit is called Purple Pansies. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you so much for having me on the show today, especially to talk about pancreatic cancer. And it's so close to Father's Day because my father is one of the people that died from pancreatic cancer in 1998.
So, Janice, tell me about your dad was an Ashkenazic Jew.
Yes.
Tell us about the process. I mean, pancreatic cancer, you know, those of us who serve as clergy know that it's not a good diagnosis, and that so much of the time, in the past at least, it's resulted in a very rapid and unpleasant death. Not that any death is pleasant. Tell us about your experience with your father.
Sure. My dad died of pancreatic cancer in 1998 at the age of 85. And I thought this way of volunteering and giving back to the community was to do something to heighten awareness and to help families in need due to the cancer and raise funds to find a cure for this deadly cancer. My dad was never really sick a day in his life. He was always full of laughter, never complained about anything. On any day, if you asked him how he was feeling, his favorite expression was, so-so like a tailor. So he was the picture of health, including brothers. And then in September of 1988, he woke up in the morning and was vomiting and dizzy. And the ambulance came, took him to the hospital, and after doing CT scans and an MRI, they diagnosed him with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. At the time he was diagnosed, my mom was also in the nursing home with Parkinson's disease. And my father died 3 months to the day. And my mother had just died 16 days before that.
Oh, my God.
Yes, I knew my father was happy because now after being with his bride for 56 years, he was with her again. So that's basically the story of my father. It's so true of so many people that die of pancreatic cancer since there's no early detection, that they don't find out till they're stage 4. And some of the risk factors are genetic. Because of our ethnicity, that we're more prone to the disease because there's a specific gene mutation that is found in Aspen County Jews that's not in others. So it's mostly Eastern European Jews that have the problem with pancreatic cancer.
So we will talk much more about that and the specifics of pancreatic cancer and its effect on Ashkenazi Jewish population. We come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store or Podbean as very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in North America. According to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean.
This Is Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Who is Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? In three fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, This Is Judaism brings you the joy of Jewish life and learning. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. Plus, you can get a sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are at the Tucson JCC, the J, and are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, This Is Judaism is completely free, but the learning is invaluable. Want to know what your new Jewish relatives are all about? Want your kids to understand Jewish heritage, history, and holidays? Want to try some delicious Jewish food? Then This Is Judaism is for you. There's no charge, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5675. Visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. This Is Judaism is taught on three consecutive Sunday afternoons in September and October at the Tucson JCC. There's a free Zoom option, but registration is required. All classes are with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Remember, there's no obligation and registration is completely free for this wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Register for This Is Judaism by calling 520-276-5675. It's the most effective introduction to Jewish learning and life ever. For your very own entry or return to Judaism, visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
There was an institution that was extraordinarily important for trade from the end of the ancient world up through the Middle Ages, really almost up to modernity. It's called the Silk Road, and I think most people don't know what it was or how important it was in the development of very far-flung Jewish communities.
Right. Well, it's an interesting concept that has a very fluid definition. Let's go back a little bit earlier to antiquity. At the peak of the Roman Empire, when the Mediterranean was essentially a Roman lake, every port on the shores of the Mediterranean had a Jewish community because they were involved in selling supplies to ships, doing ship repair, giving the merchants what they needed to keep up their business. So when Rome declined and eventually fell in the 5th century of the Common Era.
At least the western part of Rome, anyway, the Western Roman Empire.
Right. Well, there was still a Byzantine Empire, but it didn't control the whole Mediterranean anymore.
Of course.
The Mediterranean stopped being a Roman lake because there were all kinds of Goths and other so-called barbarians who took major chunks of Mediterranean real estate. But in any case, sometime in what we call the Dark Ages, sort of between the rise of Islam in the 7th century and the decline of Rome in the 5th century, two monks smuggled back silkworm eggs from China, which had been the only source in the world of silk. And all of European aristocracy, nobility, whatever, bizarrely craved silk. It was a status symbol. It was like the Lamborghini of the day,
right,
in a way.
The lightest fabric, but kind of cool in summer, kind of warm in winter. I don't know. It's beautiful. You name it.
Whatever. It's something I've never really understood. But the silk trade was very important. And by the 9th or 10th centuries, before the Crusades began, the Byzantine Empire had a monopoly on the silk trade. And they produced silk themselves because silkworms like mulberry trees, and Turkey and its neighboring countries are all full of mulberry trees. But still, the real thing, the real McCoy, came from China, as did other things like various spices and pepper and this, that, and the other thing. So there was enough in China that Western Europe wanted to maintain or actually increase this trade. They didn't have boats that could reliably bring them to China. There was no Suez Canal. It would have taken months in each direction. So they did it by land and mostly camel caravans that crossed all through Central Asia by a variety of routes. Some went pretty far north, like north of the Black Sea. Some went through Turkey. But there were certain points along this route where all the variations of the route converged. And the northwesternmost point, sort of the western terminus of the Silk Road, was Sarajevo, which we've talked about before. The eastern terminus is more arguable, but probably Xi'an. And we can talk about Xi'an in our next session.
Thank you, Tom. A great introductory explanation of a fascinating area with lots of very interesting and unique Jewish communities. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. I had a drug test at work today, and they said they found opiates. I said it was probably from the poppy seeds on my bagel. But then they asked about the THC, the hallucinogens, cocaine, and methamphetamines. I told them it was an everything bagel. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And be careful about those everything bagels. And now a word of Torah. How do we go about changing our world? And how long should we expect it to take? This week's portion, Ki Tavo, gives us powerful commandments about how we are supposed to live in society. We're commanded to be moral, to protect the rights of the impoverished, the widow, and the stranger. We are supposed to be honest in business, careful of the needs of the hungry and the homeless. We must create a society of ethical practice and moral concern. We are to understand a nation is judged by how it treats its weakest, neediest members. We are told repeatedly, God knows and expects us to live to this breed, this covenant, to uphold it, cherish it, make it our own. And we are told the blessings that will be ours if we do this, and of course, the curses we will bring on ourselves if we cannot do so. The covenant is large and challenging. Puts real responsibilities on its members, its B'nai B'rit, to do things that weren't easy or obvious, even if they were right. No doubt our ancient Israelite ancestors sometimes struggled when told to open your hand to the poor and the needy, to welcome the stranger, to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Probably they didn't always manage to give their full tithes or to make the pilgrimage to the temple to declare their gratitude for what they had. I'll even bet there were times they didn't provide adequately for the widow or the orphan, let alone the stranger in their midst. But that challenge, the daily requirement to try to live to this standard, nonetheless made them better people, made Jewish society egalitarian and generally ethical. And when they failed, they learned that what God wanted was tshuva, a return to the right course. Positive societal change was not instantaneous, but evolutionary. But it could happen for our ancestors and was codified as a practical framework by the rabbis in the Talmud. These standards should have at least as much meaning for us today. For example, after years of verbal attacks, public policy changes, even federal government persecution directed at some of the weakest members of our society, immigrants, people seeking asylum, young children, political refugees from violence. We have a responsibility as American Jews and as decent human beings to continue to work to make sure that we change and do this directly and publicly and change the way we treat them. When something isn't right, we must speak up. We must seek change. As Devarim, Deuteronomy always reminds us, we were strangers in the land of Egypt, as we later became wandering Jews in many nations all over the world. We have an obligation to help those who are now in the position we have been in so often in history. This is what the Torah teaches us in Ki Tavo. This is what God requires of us. When we come back, our guest, Janice Chalovich, tells us how the Purple Pansies organization works to combat pancreatic cancer, a disease that impacts Ashkenazic Jews at an alarming and high rate. Find out what you can do about it yourself and to help others when we return on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Birthright, the program that brings young Jews to Israel for free, is canceling its remaining 42 trips this summer because of new Israeli rules requiring Americans arriving in Israel to quarantine for a week. Since Birthright tours last just 10 days, some participants do stay longer, but still, and most participants are American, it doesn't really work. Birthright participants whose trips are canceled can sign up for new trips. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control, CDC, says there is a very high level of COVID-19 in Israel right now. Even fully vaccinated travelers may be at risk for getting and spreading COVID-19 variants. We anticipate that the 7-day quarantine rule will be temporary. We look forward to resuming trips as soon as possible, said Birthright. Birthright resumed travel in May following a 14-month hiatus. Arizona has become the 8th state to begin reviewing whether Ben & Jerry's plans to withdraw from doing business in the West Bank merits sanctions under the law targeting the Israel boycott movement. In emails last week, the state's treasurer asked Unilever, the ice cream manufacturer's parent company, to comply with its 2016 law. That law requires state entities, including pension funds, to divest from companies boycotting Israel or businesses in territories under Israel's control, explicitly including the West Bank. Treasurer's office for the state of Arizona gave Unilever 90 days to do so. Unilever and Ben & Jerry's have said they are not observing the BDS movement to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel because they are only seeking to pull out of the West Bank. They plan to continue sales in Israel. There are 34 states in total in the United States that require governments to stop doing business with companies that boycott Israel. 21 of those, like Arizona, include West Bank settlement boycotts in their definition. So far, 8 states are known to have triggered similar reviews that could result in divesting from Ben & Jerry's and Unilever. In addition to Arizona, New York, New Jersey, Florida, Texas, Illinois, Maryland, and Rhode Island have launched formal proceedings. This is significant because Arizona is a major trade partner with Israel, said IAC for Action, the legislative and policymaking arm of the Israel-American Council, which initiated the review with a formal request. Rabbi Richard Hirsch spent the 1960s bringing blacks and Jews closer in advancing civil rights in the U.S. He then spent the rest of his life bringing Reform Jews closer to Israel and advancing Zionism in the movement. Dick Hirsch died last week in Florida at the age of 95. The Cleveland native became the founding and first director of the Reform Movement's Religious Action Center, serving from 1962 to 1973. Under Dick Hirsch, the center became a lobbying powerhouse in Washington, D.C. Its DuPont Circle office became a locus for civil rights organizing. The 1964 Civil Rights Act and 1965 Voting Rights Act were drafted in large part in the conference room of the RAC. Hirsch personally lobbied President Lyndon Baines Johnson on voting rights. Hirsch was close to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and delivered the Jewish part of the assassinated civil rights eulogy in 1968. At the RAC, at the RAC Religious Action Center, Hirsch was an outspokenly pro-Israel reform rabbi. He was close to the Israeli embassy and to AIPAC, the prominent Israel lobbying group. In 1973, Hirsch assumed the leadership of the World Union for Progressive Judaism. One of his first acts was to move its offices to Jerusalem from London. The Reform Movement dubbed the move Reform Judaism's most significant decision of the 20th century. He became the leading advocate for Reformed Zionism, affiliating the movement with the World Zionist Organization and the Jewish Agency. During his more than 25 years at the World Union for Progressive Judaism, he helped found Artsa, the Reform Movement's Zionist affiliate. His rabbi son, Amiel Hirsch, a friend of mine personally, led Artsa from 1992 to 2004 before becoming the rabbi of Stephen Wise the Free Synagogue in New York. Rabbi Hirsch spurred the founding of two Reform kibbutzim in Israel. In 2010, he was the first Reform rabbi to light a torch during the Israel Independence Day celebrations. In fact, his 2011 memoir was titled For the Sake of Zion. Hirsch, a dual U.S. and Israeli citizen, remained an advocate of diaspora Jewish voices in Israeli policies, particularly as those policies impinged on the rights of non-Orthodox Jews. He said back in 1983, if diaspora Jews have the right to speak out in internal policies affecting the fate of Argentinian Jews and Russian Jews, do they not have the right to speak on issues affecting the Jews of the Jewish state? Hirsch's wife, Bella, a Russian speaker who helped him establish a Reform presence in the Soviet Union, passed away in 2019. His children say they will bury both their parents in Israel once the pandemic abates. For the past few years, our parents lived in Florida so they'd be closer to us, but it was a form of exile. His children alluded to the great 12th century Jewish thinker and poet Yehuda Halevi. While he lived in the West, his heart remained in the East. Rabbi Dick Hirsch was a student of my own grandfather, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen, a blessed memory at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. I had the pleasure of meeting him and having Shabbat with him and his family in Jerusalem when I was a student at HUC in Jerusalem a few years ago. Even in his older age, he was energetic and charismatic, engaging and entertaining. May his memory bring only blessings. And an appellate court in Poland last week rejected a lawsuit brought against two Holocaust scholars in a case that has been closely watched, here on Too Jewish as well, because it was expected to serve as a precedent for research into the highly sensitive area of Polish behavior towards Jews during World War II and the Holocaust. Poland is governed by a nationalist conservative party that has sought to promote remembrance of Polish heroism and suffering during the wartime German occupation of the country. That party also believes discussions of Polish wrongdoing distort the historical picture and are unfair to Poles. The Appellate Court of Warsaw argued in its explanation it believed that it's not the responsibility of the courts to judge scholarly research. The ruling was welcomed by the researchers Jan Grabowski and Barbara Engelking, important scholars, who declared it a great victory. We greet the verdict with joy and satisfaction that this decision has a direct impact on all Polish scholars and especially on historians of the Holocaust, they said. Last week's ruling comes half a year after a lower court ordered the two researchers to apologize to a woman who claimed her deceased uncle had been defamed in a historical work they edited and partially wrote, Night Without End, The Fate of Jews in Selected Counties of Occupied Poland. Lawyers for the niece, 81-year-old Filomena Leszczynska, argued that her uncle was a Polish hero who saved Jews and that the scholars had harmed her good name and that of her family by suggesting the uncle was also involved in killing Jews. The plaintiff's lawyer, Monica Brzeszowa-Pasieka, argued in February there was no attempt to stifle researcher speech. Some researchers and others feared that if the researchers were punished, it would have a chilling effect, dissuading young scholars from taking up the sensitive issue of Polish behavior towards Jews in World War II. Poland was occupied, of course, by Nazi Germany during the war, its population subjected to mass murder and slave labor. Amid the more than 5 years of German occupation, there were some Poles who betrayed Jews to the Nazis or took part in their killing, while other Poles risked their lives to save Jews. The topic of Polish crimes against Jews was taboo during the communist era, and new revelations of Polish wrongdoing in recent years have sparked a backlash. Poland's current ruling Law and Justice Party vowed to fight what it considers unfair depictions of Polish wrongdoing, preferring to promote remembrance of heroism and sacrifice. Researchers and the Israeli government have accused the Polish government of historical whitewashing. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Round the World.
This Is Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Who is Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? In three fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, This Is Judaism brings you the joy of Jewish life and learning. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. Plus, you can get a sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are at the Tucson JCC, the J, and are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, This Is Judaism is completely free, but the learning is invaluable. Want to know what your new Jewish relatives are all about? Want your kids to understand Jewish heritage, history, and holidays? Want to try some delicious Jewish food? Then This Is Judaism is for you. There's no charge, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5675. Visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. This Is Judaism is taught on three consecutive Sunday afternoons in September and October at the Tucson JCC. There's a free Zoom option, but registration is required. All classes are with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Remember, there's no obligation, and registration is completely free for this wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Register for This Is Judaism by calling 520-276-5675. It's the most effective introduction to Jewish learning and life ever. For your very own entry or return to Judaism, visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675.
We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Janice Chalovich is the president of Purple Pansies, which works to educate and fight the terrible cancer, pancreatic cancer. You started to talk at the beginning of the show about its prevalence among Ashkenazic Jews. Obviously, we don't know why there's a genetic predisposition in this way, but it certainly impacted your dad, who died of pancreatic cancer. What populations is it? You know, what's the difference in terms of the likelihood of Ashkenazic Jews getting pancreatic cancer?
Well, basically, 80% of the cases occur between ages of 50 to 80 years old. And studies show that fathers, sons, or brothers that got this disease are at greater risk. And there's no percentages they actually give for Ashkenazi Jews, but they do find in research that there seems to be Eastern European eccentricities that. So Purple Pansies, basically, the reason I volunteer for Purple Pansies is because of the fact that I retired in 2017 and wanted to find a way to give back to our community. So Maria Fontora, the founder of Purple Pansies, I met her in 2015, and her mom had also died of cancer, and she had pancreatic cancer in 2008. So Purple Pansies has helped me to learn a lot about this cancer. And what the problem is the pancreas is hidden behind the stomach, and it works so closely with the liver and the duct that carries bile that there's no early warning signs, and that's why so many people get diagnosed at stage four. So it's really important for people to understand the risk factors and the symptoms of pancreatic cancer, and especially because of our eccentricity. So things like the risk factors would be smoking, obesity, heavy alcohol use, genetics, as I've mentioned before, and diabetes. All the researchers are just finding out that diabetes is actually another root cause of cancer. And then the symptoms usually are weight loss, nausea, indigestion, jaundice, pain in the abdomen and back, and appetite loss. And most of these symptoms seem like, okay, I get that once in a while, but once they're recurring, people seem to ignore them, and they really need to have them checked out, because these symptoms are what we hear people every day that we work with say, well, I was having little back problems, and I was losing weight, and when they go to the doctor, then they're already at stage 3 and stage 4. as I said, my father was never very disciplined in life until he was.
So I want to note that early detection is really critical. I have a close friend, a rabbi, who was living in Israel, totally healthy, and somehow or other they caught it, and it was, I don't know, stage one or two, went through a full treatment program. He's totally healthy, had three young kids. He's fine. I had only known people who had died, to be honest, so I was shocked. We thought it was kind of a death sentence. It turned out not to be. It's really important for people to get early detection, isn't it?
It is. There are certain procedures that can be done when somebody's in the early stages. One of them is called the Wiggles disease, so that's possibly what he had. But that operation is a complex operation, and most people are not able to have it done because they're not at that stage. There's also so many clinical trials now that are available to people. And we have actually, within our organization, one 17-year survivor, an 11-year survivor. And this was actually a woman who found out she had pancreatic cancer and she was giving birth. The doctor noticed that her pancreas was enlarged.
Wow.
She found out at that time actually had pancreatic cancer. So it affects men and women. This year, probably 60,000 people expected to die of pancreatic cancer, or be diagnosed with it, And that means each day, 165 Americans who are probably friends, family members, or colleagues will be diagnosed with this pancreatic cancer each day. So that's a scary number. It's the third leading cause of cancer-related deaths in the U.S. and expected to be number two over the next few years.
The challenge then is to diagnose something that doesn't seem to be, that's asymptomatic, right, until it's spread.
Exactly.
How do they detect it? Is it a blood test? Like, how do they find it in when they do find it?
Well, they're working now on blood tests actually to help with early detection. But the only way that it's diagnosed now is through CT scans or an MRI. So as I say, clinical trials are available. A couple teams in partnership with CGEN in Phoenix, Arizona, which is Transitional Genomics. And Dr. Vernon Hoff, who is one of the leading doctors in the world for pancreatic cancer, actually has developed three of the four drugs that are approved for treatment in advanced pancreatic cancer. So couple cans can help families who need to be directed to CGEN if they're in stage four to help with these clinical trials.
If you are an Ashkenazic Jew, which is, you know, obviously a whole lot of American Jews, you have a higher potential for developing pancreatic cancer. Do you just go to your doctor and say, I want to be checked? I mean, that's probably not going to happen, is it?
No, but they do suggest, like CGEN suggests that, and many doctors suggest, that if you have a family member that has had pancreatic cancer, especially, like I said, a father, son, or a brother, that you should ask your doctor to be tested because the generic can show you the genes that possibly could cause this pancreatic cancer in the system. So I myself have not been tested, but they do say that especially men over the age of 35 should be tested.
Where can people go to find out more about Purple Pansies, about the work that you're doing to fight pancreatic cancer and to help people discover if they have it? Where do they go?
Purple Pansies has our own website. We do a few fundraisers each year. The website is purplepansies.org. And earlier we talked about Purple Pansies and my affiliation with it. And where the name Purple Pansies came from was our founder. One day, in the field in the center, and she put his pansy bloom, and that has got the name because she said, pansies are the flowers that have grandstands along. So she named our foundation Purple Pansies. We are a fully volunteer organization, and the funds raised go directly to research and education.
Is there hope of finding more, less invasive and less destructive treatments that have a higher percentage chance of success with pancreatic cancer now?
The research is every day working on this. I happened to see a patient 2 months ago in Arizona, and my next was after looking through Microsoft. That's what Mr. Tobin checks, but they're working every day as hard to, as much as they can to solve the problem, but they're also the biggest thing is to have early detection. There's nothing like now. All over the world they're working on, not just in the United States. So we're praying that with the funds we raise, that there will be somebody that can help us have early detection, especially if it could be through a blood test.
Tell us where the name Purple Pansies comes from.
That's what I said before. Purple Pansies comes from our founder when she was out in her garden in the middle of the winter looking for flowers. And she saw a pansy bloom, and it happened to be a purple one. And she thought, wow, this is a flower that really has strength and can survive. And so that's where she got the name Purple Pansies.
I want to thank Janice Chalovich for her visit here on Too Jewish. And again, where can people go to find out more about Purple Pansies and to help in the work of fighting pancreatic cancer?
You can visit us at our website at purplepansies.org. And please also remember all the caregivers that take care of these patients that are sick, because it's the honor to talk to them. And they need support as well.
Thank you so much.
Have a wonderful day.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Charles Lichtman, author of the new thriller, The Sword of David. Our playout this morning comes for the Jewish High Holy Days, beginning September 6th, not long from now. Or, I guess, with Slichot on the last Saturday night in August. This is a time when you can come join us in person at Congregation Beit Simcha for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up for a beautiful, meaningful, musical High Holy Day experience for 5782, either in person or online. To play us out, here's another Areshet Sfateinu, a different setting. Open our lips in prayer to you, God, during the shofar service and always. Rosh Hashanah starts Monday night, September 6th. Don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services and Oneg Shabbat, all starting at 6:30 p.m. and Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services and Torah reading. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of health and of peace.
Mevino mabit mazin makshiv lekol tekio seinu.
Mevino mabit mazin makshiv lekol tekio seinu.
Uskapel berachamim berachmim uverotzon seider malchu yoseinu.
Uskapel berachamim berachmim uverotzon seider seider malchu yoseinu.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.